Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, fascinating information is available from La Florida, the interactive digital archive of the Americas.
It's like you think you know the demographic of Spanish Florida, and then you start playing with the filters and working on places of origin, and then you see that people from Scotland, Croatia, Welsh, Spanish Florida isn't just Spanish.
We'll discuss the environmental history of the Hillsborough River in the mid-20th century.
The Hillsborough River was a popular site for recreation, swimming, boating, and fishing, and participants in these outdoor activities demanded clean water.
And we'll talk about the unknown Indian graves in St. Augustine. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. La Florida, the interactive digital archive of the Americas, accessible online at lafloridaorg, brings to life the diverse population of Spanish colonial Florida in St. Augustine. Amy Anderson is project manager for the La Florida Interactive Digital Archive.
We love Florida history, so our fundamental goal at the beginning was to be able to share the research in an interactive and accessible way. So accessibility is the project goal at its core, bringing the Florida past to the largest audience possible. And by doing that in an innovative way combined with rigorous research, our hope is to increase the curiosity and interest about Florida's early history.
To create the different aspects of this digital archive, the La Florida team used records dating back to 1594. As Amy Anderson explains, the Lost Voices portion of the website was recently completed.
For this project, we utilized the entire collection of the St. Augustine Parish Archive. This archive is the oldest surviving parish archive in the United States, including Puerto Rico, with records dating back to 1594, like you said. The documents are sacramental documents in nature, which means they're baptisms, confirmations, marriages, and death and burial. The records are organized into 16 books and then 14 boxes, and by boxes, literal boxes with loose leaf pages in them that were not always in order, so that kept things interesting. So between those books and boxes, there's over 8,200 pages, and these documents are varying in condition. Some are worm-eaten, water-damaged, a couple are laminated from early preservation attempts, and of course, they're in varying languages. Majority are in Spanish. There's about 1,000 in Latin, because why not? And then a handful are in English. And they're also handwritten, obviously. And what we learned is every scribe is different. So we had various scribes keeping these records. And we do have a couple that are just gorgeous. I mean, aesthetically pleasing documents. We have a couple that are a little more difficult to read, to say the least. For this project, for Lost Voices, our time frame was 1594 to 1821. We thought the cutoff for Florida being transferred as a U.S. territory was a good place to stop. But the records do extend until about 1888. So if for some reason your passions extend past colonial Florida, we do have some stuff on the site in that area as well.
In 2012, the La Florida team was granted permission to transcribe and digitize the St. Augustine colonial era documents and make them accessible online. The next step was to find funding to translate the documents and make the translations available on the website.
So in 2019, we were ambitious and applied for a grant with the National Archives for $250,000. And spoiler alert, we won, which was wonderful. And with that grant and support from the Huff Family Foundation, the Lastinger Family Foundation, and Frankie Duckwall Foundation, we were able to start the next big phase, which was transcription and translation. We knew a brilliant paleographer based in Seville, Esther Gonzalez, who agreed to transcribe all 8,200 plus pages. And she ended up knowing Latin, which, you know, those pesky documents that I was complaining about, she was not only able to transcribe them for us, but she translated the Latin into Spanish, which really helped streamline our translation process. You know, with one transcriber, three translators, and then seven of us working on data registration, which was collecting all possible data points. You know, we had names, ages, races, familial connections, places of origin. Put it bluntly, we had over 30 spreadsheets, and some of those had over 250 columns, over 16,000 rows. You know, we wanted to extract every morsel of data from these documents to make sure we didn't miss anything. And then the final step was working with the wonderful tech team in Southern Spain, who showed us how to take our data, translate it into a language a database could read, and then migrate it so that it's in the format you see on the site today.
Other aspects of the LaFlorida.org website include short video presentations about selected residents of Spanish colonial Florida, an interactive map section, and a fun feature that allows users to transcribe email messages into colonial-era scripts. Amy Anderson says that the La Florida website is useful for historians, genealogists, and the general public.
We spent a lot of time talking about potential audiences for this project when we first began development. We decided we wanted to create a site that had appealed to the widest audience possible. You know, obviously we wanted students of Florida history and professional scholars, grad students, but you know, we wanted genealogists. We wanted people that were interested in Florida, tourists. You know, you don't have to be getting a dissertation to get something from the site. We anticipate that everyone can find something that they like on the site. And then for the value, I mean, these parish records include biographical data for more than 70,000 people. This information includes all kinds of insight into the daily life of St. Augustine. You know, Ben, I'll tell you, a number of these individuals who appear in these records, this is the only time we see them in historical records. And, you know, I mentioned that there's baptisms, confirmation, marriage, death. There are some people that are born in St. Augustine, get confirmed, get married, and die. So we've got them all through the records. And it's almost like time traveling. You're following them on this amazing journey. So I think there's an amazing amount of value. These records show how diverse colonial Florida was. And again, I think a lot of people will get something out of it. Again, you don't have to be a professional scholar to get and learn something off of this site.
While collating, transcribing, translating, and digitizing these documents, Amy Anderson and the La Florida team were introduced to fascinating everyday people who lived in Spanish colonial St. Augustine.
One of my favorites just that's on there right now is Luisa de Abrego. And I don't want to spoil too much. I think people should definitely check out the site, but hers is a story. She's a free Black domestic servant who boards a ship from Seville to St. Augustine. It's about 1565. Once she's in Florida, she marries a blacksmith from Segovia, Miguel Rodriguez. First, this is the oldest documented Christian marriage in the continental U.S. So that on its own is incredible. The fact that it's between a free Black woman and essentially a Spanish conquistador making it an interracial marriage is incredible. So that document on its own was already outstanding. And then the fact that we found it in the Spanish Inquisition documents housed in Mexico City, where it becomes this bigamy case because she thinks she's got two husbands now. She doesn't know if her first marriage was legitimate or not. It's like peeling an onion. You can't get enough of it. So that was really incredible. And I think it shows the value of these documents. You don't know what you're going to find until you start reading through them. We really hit a treasure trove with some of these documents.
One of the most potentially useful aspects of the LaFlorida.org website is the digital visualization tool.
We call it the DVT, just because it's obviously a mouthful. Again, we wanted to make the information accessible. Early in our beta testing sessions, you know, we're working with a lot of content and you were learning a lot of stuff, but there were some points that you just wanted to directly ask a question. So we created the DVT for that very purpose. On the DVT, you can ask questions like how many men versus women were in St. Augustine during, you know, 1594 to 1821. And you'll get an infographic that shows you the data. And then what's nice, you start thinking of more questions to ask it after you get involved. And now, okay, how many of those men and women were enslaved? How many were free? And sometimes the answers are not what you expect. Like you think you know the demographic of Spanish Florida. And then you start playing with the filters and working on places of origin. And then you see that people from Scotland, Croatia, Welsh, Spanish Florida isn't just Spanish. So it's really interesting. And the DVT is a great way to kind of help show those infographics in a different way. And you're able to kind of play with it and start asking thought-provoking questions, really.
Amy Anderson is project manager for La Florida, the Interactive Digital Archive of the Americas, online at laflorida.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the Hillsborough River, which originates in the Green Swamp, has long been recognized for its beauty and is often described as a piece of old Florida, but the middle and lower sections of the river have a more problematic environmental history, especially during the three decades from 1950 to 1980.
Brad Massey, curator of public history at the Tampa Bay History Center and professor of history at Polk State College, addressed the complex and problematic history of the Hillsborough River in his article, Tampa's Multipurposed Waterway, which was published in the fall 2018 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Exploring the environmental impact of rapid population growth, he follows in the footsteps of urban-suburban environmentalists like Adam Rome, whose 2006 book, Bulldozer in the Countryside, described the connections between post-World War II suburban growth and the American environmental movement. Massey asserts that his article, quote, reinforces Rome's assertion that the environmental concerns of U.S. citizens and policymakers were shaped by the proliferation of suburban tract homes and the ecological damage their construction and maintenance inflicted on the American suburban dream, end quote. Whereas Rome focused on the destruction of habitats and forests and the preparation of building sites and explored the environmental degradation that accompanied the decision to install septic tanks rather than extend sewer lines to new subdivisions, Massey concentrated his research on the Hillsborough River that supplied water to Tampa and its suburbs. His analysis of the role of water places his research within the context of other Florida environmental historians who have focused on the Everglades, the Cross Florida Barge Canal, and the Gulf of Mexico, and expands our understanding of the intersection of the environment and development. Massey begins with a description of the Hillsborough River and its 50-mile flow from the Green Swamp to the north end of Tampa Bay. It begins as something more akin to a sheet of slow-moving swamp water until it reaches Crystal Spring. Empowered by the spring's outflow, it morphs into a narrow, year-round stream. Flowing southward, the river turns east and widens at a dam built by Consumers Electric Light and Power Company, now controlled by the Tampa Water Department. It is at this point that the city of Tampa extracts water for public use. After passing the dam, the river narrows again and completes its journey at the upper Tampa Bay. Massey ties the increasing pollution of the river to the rapid population rise and the increasing residential and industrial development in Hillsborough County in the post-World War II era. He argues that Tampa, quote, was an epicenter of the population boom. And cites data that shows Hillsborough County population rose from 249,844 in 1950 to 646,960 in 1980. 800 new businesses relocated to the area. In 1978, U.S. News and World Report named Tampa one of the star cities of the South.
Connie, Floridians have long experience with both the short-term benefits and long-term consequences of booms. Tampa's suburbanization was no doubt accompanied by environmental degradation that included many of the problems Adam Rome identified, right?
While Tampans welcomed the investment in their city and county, they openly worried about the effects rapid development was having on their quality of life. And the concerns were not misplaced, particularly in regard to the source of their water supply. Most Florida cities draw their water from the state's large underground aquifer, but Tampa City water comes from the Hillsborough River. The use of river water increased the cost of treatment for human consumption, and there were other issues as well. The Hillsborough River was a popular site for recreation, swimming, boating, and fishing, and participants in these outdoor activities demanded clean water. Finally, to address the river's history of flooding, the Florida legislature created the Southwest Florida Water Management District and constructed a bypass canal. The reduction in flooding encouraged the construction of additional housing, serviced by leaky septic tanks. As pollution of the Hillsborough River increased throughout the 1960s and 1970s, an eclectic group of residents, journalists, politicians, and scientists call for action. Three major pollution events in the year 1969-1970 produced more formal environmental organization and pitted the various groups against the pro-growth city and county governments and developers. In February 1969, five companies, including shrimp and citrus processing plants and the Plant City Wastewater Department, dumped untreated waste into the Pemberton Creek, which flowed into Lake Thonatosassa. Within 48 hours, 80% of the fish had died. 3 months later, a fatal truck crash spilled 6,200 gallons of oil into the river. And in February 1970, the oil tanker Delian Apollon ran aground and spilled 20,000 gallons of heavy crude into Tampa Bay. As Massey explains, the crude oil spill, quote, capped off a 12-month industrial pollution trifecta that was sparked by urban growth, end quote.
Connie, environmental concerns are rarely resolved by a single organization, as the complexity of identifying and finding solutions for issues such as pollution attract the research and activism of multiple interest groups. Such was the case in Tampa as well, with participation by some historic groups as well as new single-issue environmental organizations.
Local Sierra Club chapters advocated river cleanup, especially for the upper river where canoeing and other naturalist activities occurred. In 1974, 322,000 acres were designated for preservation in the Green Swamp at the instigation of the Sierra Club, and the 17 Runs area was designated as a protective wilderness area. Save Our Bay, Incorporated, formed in 1969, lobbied for a cleaner watershed by fighting against new development and against dredging operations in the bay. When the Audubon Society and the League of Women Voters joined the activists in 1973, a new organization merged the three to form Hillsborough Environmental Coalition, HEC. The 1972 Clean Water Act and the Florida Wilson Grizzle Act energized the activists and provided them with new legal foundations on which to press their claims. Two highly visible and vocal environmental activists also emerged in the early 70s. Roger Stewart, a trained zoologist and constant critic of unrestrained development, headed the Hillsborough County Environmental Protection Commission, EPC. His appearance on 60 Minutes got him fired in 1972, though he was quickly reinstated. John Betts was a University of South Florida biology professor and a member of the Tampa City Council's Advisory Committee on the Environment. Although the elected officials remained firmly on the side of development, Massey claims the momentum shifted toward the environmentalist claims when, in early 1974, the Florida Department of Pollution Control entered the fray and threatened to block new sewage hookups to Tampa's treatment facility if pollutants were not curtailed. Federal funding allowed a new $90 million treatment facility to come online in 1980, but delays in upgrading sewer lines meant the continuation of pollution problems. Massey concludes that after the early 80s, the pollution issues declined, but, quote, the waters of the Hillsborough River improved, but were and are far from pristine, end quote. Although the river is far less polluted today than in 1970, it is still affected by the continuing growth that raised the population to 1.2 million in 2016. In the face of ongoing issues, Hillsborough environmentalists continue to engage in battles over Tampa's signature river.
And the fight continues. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Holly Baker has this report on efforts to identify who is buried in the unknown Indian graves in St. Augustine.
Dr. Amy Giroux is Associate Director of the Center for Humanities and Digital Research, or CHEDR, in the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. While researching burial sites in St. Augustine National Cemetery through her work with the National Cemetery Administration, she came across two separate graves, each containing a group burial of six warriors, marked with a headstone inscribed, Six Unknown Indians.
So about 5 years ago now, I was working for the Veterans Legacy Program in St. Augustine National Cemetery. And at that time, UCF's History Department had a grant with the National Cemetery Administration to do work in various Florida national cemeteries. And during that same time period, the National Cemetery Administration hired me as a digital historian. And what that meant was I was tasked with figuring out ways to digitize the physical spaces of the cemeteries. And working in St. Augustine was great because the cemetery is small. It's about an acre and a half. And I spent lots of time there flying drones and creating maps and 3D modeling monuments and things like that. And in the cemetery, as I walked through it daily, you know, to do all this work, I noticed the amount of headstones that had unknown U.S. soldier. And then there's these two that say unknown, six unknown Indians. I was quite curious as to why there were 12 Indians buried in St. Augustine National Cemetery.
During the Plains Indian Wars in the late 1800s, thousands of indigenous peoples were forced from their homelands. Dozens of their leaders and warriors were imprisoned in Fort Marion.
So I started researching to try to figure out who they were. And as I got into the documents, both at the National Cemetery Administration's archive, the National Archives, and, you know, various other online repositories, I figured out that there had been prisoners at what was called Fort Marion during the time frame that the army took over the fort and the barracks there. Three sets of prisoners had been taken to Fort Marion. 1837, some of the Seminoles were imprisoned there. 1875 to 1878, there were five Plains Indian tribes imprisoned there. And then in 1886, the Apache were imprisoned there.
Fort Marion was used as a prison for warriors and chiefs, with the goal to demoralize their tribes into surrendering to the U.S. Army. The prisoners were forced to become a military company, and their native customs and beliefs were suppressed in order to assimilate them into white culture. Many of them died while in captivity.
So looking into the 1875 to 1878 time period, when it was Cheyenne, Arapaho, Comanche, Kiowa, and Caddo prisoners, I found evidence of there were deaths there during that time period. I came across the documentation that I was looking for and identified there were 10 deaths of those prisoners in Florida. One of them was a Cheyenne chief named Graybeard. He leapt from the train that was transporting them to St. Augustine, just east of Lake City. And he was trying to escape and go back to Oklahoma, or what it, Indian territory at the time. It's present day Oklahoma. And the army guards that were there tried to find him. And when he broke cover and started to run, they shot him. He died a couple hours later on the train, and they left his body with the railroad crew in Baldwin, which is about 18 miles west of Jacksonville, to be buried. They proceeded on to St. Augustine. And during the 3 years that they were in St. Augustine, 9 other prisoners passed away from diseases. So there were 6 Cheyenne who died during that time period. There were 3 Kiowa and 1 Comanche.
Researchers from the University of Central Florida are collaborating with the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma, the National Park Service, the National Cemetery Administration, and Flagler College, in order to remember and honor the men held as prisoners at Fort Marion. Dr. Amy Giroux.
The National Park Service actually reached out to me. Steve Roberts, who is director of education at the Castillo de San Marcos in St. Augustine, reached out to me and said, from what I understand, you know where they're buried. And the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes have been working with Steve at the fort for changing interpretive signage. So they invited me to meetings last August at the Castillo to discuss some events that they were having in November of last year. And I was able to take Noreen Starr, who is a descendant of 2 of the prisoners, Heap of Birds and Big Moccasin, and I was able to take her and the other folks from the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes to the cemetery and show them where they're buried. These prisoners were brought here in the 1870s. Some were young men at the time. Some were older men. Heap of Birds was 49 years old when he died in St. Augustine. That space is sacred, knowing where they wound up and where they're interred is very important.
The National Cemetery Administration plans to replace the 2 6 unknown Indian grave markers with headstones that list the names of the men, their death dates, and their tribal affiliations. To learn more about this project and the Veterans Legacy Program, go to vlp.cah.ucf.edu. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Visit our content-rich website anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.